From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was senior White House advisor for four of the most tumultuous years of the Clinton presidency. In that time, he made friends and enemies. But Sidney Blumenthal remains a self-professed, unapologetic, undiminished Clinton admirer. And in his new book, he makes the case for Bill and Hillary, for the Clinton legacy, and for the future of progressive politics in America. But has he got it right? Tonight on Point, Sidney Blumenthal, Inside the Clinton Wars. We begin with continued turmoil and an important capture in Iraq today. One American soldier was killed and another wounded in a drive-by shooting in Baghdad this morning. In a separate incident, U.S. soldiers fired into a crowd of former Iraqi soldiers protesting their dismissal and canceled paychecks. Two Iraqis were reportedly killed. There is progress in the hunt for Saddam loyalists, however. American forces have captured Abid Hamid Mahmoud al-Tikriti, Saddam's presidential secretary and the number four man on the U.S. most wanted list. Eileen Prusher has been covering Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her to describe the importance of finding the man marked as the ace of diamonds in the card deck of most wanted Iraqi leaders.
Actually, that was known as the secretary of Saddam Hussein. He's been somebody who was, a sort of gatekeeper to Saddam, as far as we know, was in charge of going and, getting a lot of things done for Saddam. So it seems that, anything that really came out of Saddam's office, from what I'm told by my sources, went through him. So what some people said to me this evening was that if we got him, we must be getting closer, because he would have been close to where Saddam was.
Also reports today of $8 or $9 million in U.S. cash and much more in Euro cash and jewels found in Tikrit. Was that part of the same operation that rounded up Abid Hamid Mahmoud al-Tikriti?
It's not entirely clear. It does seem likely that that was part of the same trail. I mean, there have been indications all along that parts of Saddam's entourage went to Tikrit to hide out. It's still an area that's considered more or less loyal to Saddam Hussein. But of course, it doesn't seem as though that's the only place they would have went to, because on some level, it's sort of an obvious place. We knew all along that, when the regime fell, that would be, a very likely hiding place for them. So it seems that it's probably one of the trails that leads to Saddam and his immediate associates, but certainly not the only one.
Meanwhile, back in Baghdad, we've been following the story of the Iraqi army staff who showed up to protest and ended up, some of them, being killed. Is there any follow-on to that, Eileen Prusher?
Yes, well, in fact, there seem to be conflicting reports over whether or not these Iraqis were killed or just injured, and we've been trying tonight to confirm exactly what happened. But what we can say for certain is the people who were out, lots of Iraqis were out protesting. They're all Iraqi military officers who lost their jobs a couple of weeks ago when Paul Bremer, the top U.S. official here, suspended the army. And, that's something that's considered by the Bush administration to be a crucial step towards starting a new Iraqi system, whether it's the military or the ministries and the government. But a lot of Iraqis are very upset about that decision. A lot of people, particularly in the army, feel that they were sort of the middle and lower ranks of the military. They don't consider themselves Baathist, or so many of them say. And they just feel that an important Iraqi institution is being broken up. So they were out protesting for that when things seemed to have gotten out of hand. There were either some bottles or bricks thrown at soldiers, and the soldiers fired back. It was really quite a chaotic scene. Of course, as you've heard, a soldier was killed and shot and killed a few hours after that. So things really do seem to be tense right now on the streets of Baghdad.
Eileen, what's going on? Are the attacks on American soldiers growing more frequent, growing more deadly?
Both. Actually, the attacks on the U.S. soldiers, they used to be a little bit more sporadic. We'd see them every few days. Now we're seeing them almost every day, sometimes a few times a day. They've tended to be focused on the area we just spoke about, Tikrit, and also the area west of Baghdad, either Fallujah or Ramadi. Those are areas that are considered to be more or less hostile to U.S. forces, and in some cases loyal to the Baathist party. And it does seem to be something that if there's not an attack in one of those areas one day, it's in the other one. But many people are trying to discern whether or not this means there's some kind of real organized resistance, or whether or not this is just pockets, different cells, different groups of Iraqis coming together to try to launch attacks on U.S. forces. What we can say for certain is there is a lot of frustration out there, even among average Iraqis. They're often complaining, we want to know, you know, when is all of our electricity going to come back? When will our economy be okay? When will we have a government again? And all of that frustration and anger seems to be mixing in with some of these attacks on the U.S. forces. It's very difficult to determine exactly where and who these attacks are coming from.
The head of the U.S. occupation there, Paul Bremer, is trying to cool down, apparently, some of the Iraqi sentiment by clamping down on what is in Iraqi newspapers. You write that there's already some pretty hot rhetoric in Baghdad newspapers. Particularly, you point to the broadsheet paper there, Asa, which is quite popular. What's the paper saying?
Yes, and in fact, I was just reporting on that, and one of the headlines in today's paper was Bremer is a Ba'athist. I mean, it's certainly a sort of incendiary headline, but I think the intention of the paper, as I could tell from speaking to the editor, was to somehow show that the U.S. Occupation or the U.S. forces here and U.S. officials are doing some of the same things that Saddam did by putting restrictions on the media. However, it's probably being in some ways taken really out of context. I mean, the idea of these media restrictions was essentially to say we don't want to allow very insightful material to be printed in papers that might be targeted against various ethnic or religious groups. That seemed to be the heart of this new policy, but it also does say nothing in the media can be used to incite against the coalition forces here. And some of the stories that we've been seeing in the newspapers really sort of straddle the border between harsh criticism and incitement. And that newspaper that you just mentioned is one of those ones that I think a lot of people will be watching closely because it's become a very popular newspaper. And, for example, the editor told me that in a few days they'll be coming out with a story saying that U.S. soldiers are going around abusing or insulting the Quran. Certainly these are things that they're bound to get people upset. And it's a time, of course, of so many new publications being out on the market. Some of them are acting very responsibly, and some of them probably are not.
You write that the front page editorial in Asa in Baghdad today accuses Mr. Bremer's policy of being similar to those of Saddam Hussein. And in your translation, it's quoted saying, now they, that is the Americans, now they put plastic bags on our heads, throw us to the ground, and accuse us of being agents of Saddam Hussein. In other words, if you're not with America, you're with Saddam. Mr. Bremer, you remind us of Saddam. This is pretty hot language.
I would agree with you, yeah. I think that's something that perhaps, you know, in Iraqi society, a lot of people might turn to that and say, well, yes, he's right, and become perhaps more upset about the U.S. And, you know, I think it's going to be a real challenge for the coalition and for Mr. Bremer and his whole team to decide, you know, is language like that acceptable under this media policy? And, you know, furthermore, is the media really the issue? Perhaps, you know, what exactly is going into the newspapers is less of an issue than how Iraqis are feeling about the entire post-war program as a whole. And one of the things that we're really seeing is that there's this sort of disconnect between expectations among Iraqis and among the coalition forces and other parties who are involved in the post-war rebuilding process. I think Iraqis are expecting it to go a lot more quickly, and they're growing kind of upset and disillusioned by the fact that the process of moving to some kind of Iraqi interim administration is taking much longer, going much more slowly than they expected.
The Asa editorial ends, we've waited a long time to be free, now you want us to be slaves. Sounds like some rough sledding ahead there. Eileen Prusher, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Eileen Prusher has been covering Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us tonight from Baghdad. Tour through Sidney Blumenthal's new book is a true blue supporters tour through the Clinton years. Your guide is a self-described first night of the Clinton administration. Chapter titles tell the tale, the challenge to the old order, Hillary under siege, in Starr's chamber, the reign of witches, show trial, the stolen succession. Blumenthal's 800-page opus makes the case for Bill and Hillary on everything from impeachment to Travelgate to Whitewater to that woman. A senior White House advisor from 1997 to 2001, Sidney Blumenthal stood at Clinton's right hand for four of the most tumultuous years in the modern American presidency. And he remains as loyal as they come. He calls Clinton's Republican enemies velociraptors in bow ties. Blumenthal's own critics don't pull punches either. El Cid and Sid Vicious, they've called him. But beyond the partisan battles and bloodletting of the Clinton years, Blumenthal writes, a deeper conflict was cutting across America and still cuts today. Does the country want a conservative president with stripped-down federal ambitions? Or does it want, as he sees Clinton, a progressive president who believes government can and must do much more? Now, on the eve of another election season, the question arises again, what kind of president do Americans want? And in the era of George W., how does the Clinton legacy measure up? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Dallas, Texas, is Sidney Blumenthal, former senior White House advisor to Bill Clinton and author of the new book, The Clinton Wars. Good evening and welcome, Sidney Blumenthal.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Tom.
Good to have you. And with us in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Sidney. Nice to have you on the program.
Oh, good to hear from you again, Jack.
Sidney Blumenthal, there's so much in this book, we won't get to anywhere near all of it tonight, but we want to dive in on the Clinton legacy and also on the big cycles that you describe of conservative and progressive presidents in American history. It'd be great if you would just start up by giving us, in a nutshell, how you see that cycle and where you see Bill Clinton as having fallen in that cycle.
Well, I believe that there are cycles in American history, as Arthur Schlesinger has pointed out, of conservatism and liberalism, of progressive presidents and conservative presidents. Bill Clinton falls into that cycle. He is the successor in many ways to the tradition that stretches back to the beginning of using the executive with great energy to animate government for new tasks that expand democracy. That goes back even to those who talked about small government, Thomas Jefferson. It goes through some Republicans, Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, then through Franklin Roosevelt, then through Kennedy and Johnson, and then to Clinton. Clinton was the first president of his generation, the 60s generation, my own generation. And basically, he was a magnet that divided politics into poles. And essentially, if you thought the 60s were positive, you were generally positive about Bill Clinton. If you thought they were negative, you generally hated Bill Clinton. And you thought that there was a culture war that was going on and that he was on the wrong side of it because he represented the negative side of the 1960s.
But when Republicans went after Bill Clinton, you say, Sidney Blumenthal, in your view, they were essentially going after the whole idea of a progressive, hands-on presidency.
No question about it. Bill Clinton was, in my view, a progressive president. He had many stumbles, many failures, many errors. He was a study of growth in office and learned a great deal and accomplished an enormous amount, although we have left an unfinished agenda. The reason that the intense, hostile opposition arose was to stop this president and his progressive agenda.
We're going to look at that tonight, Sidney Blumenthal. We're going to look at that in some depth tonight. If you'll stand by for just a second, Jack Beatty, before we go to the break, and it's coming right up. Here are the cycles of American presidencies laid out by Sidney Blumenthal and Bill Clinton placed in them. Do you see him standing in that place that Sid Blumenthal described?
Well, that's where he seemed to fall. The mechanism of these cycles, as I remember it from Arthur Schlesinger, is generational memory. People in the 60s, young people, wanted a revival of the politics of public purpose they were raised in. And then when the generational cycle is full, when they're at their most influential, they get the president they want. The question is whether Bill Clinton was that president. I think this, and Sidney makes every kind of argument for him, but I think you can't. Facts are stubborn things, and two historic failures mark his term, the failure of health care reform and the loss of the House of Representatives. From 1930 to 1994, with the exception of 2 years, Democratic, Bill Clinton loses it.
We're going to come back and look at all this. We're talking tonight about the American presidency and the Clinton legacy with Bill Clinton's White House advisor and unflagging admirer, Sidney Blumenthal. You can join the conversation in the age of Bush. How does Bill Clinton look to you now? Is it time again for a progressive presidency Was Bill Clinton's a progressive presidency? And what is the Clinton legacy, substance or scandal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American presidency and the Clinton legacy with Bill Clinton's White House advisor and unflagging admirer, Sidney Blumenthal, author of the new book, The Clinton Wars. You can join the conversation. Do you want a president who restrains government, takes it to the sidelines, or a president who embraces the politics of remedy and puts government to work? Was Bill Clinton the victim of a vast right-wing conspiracy, or was he dogged by his own weaknesses? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sidney Blumenthal, in your book, The Clinton Wars, you do a lot of comparing of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. It might be interesting to hear you put George W. Bush and Bill Clinton side by side a bit tonight as they fit into your vision of cycles of presidencies.
Couldn't be more different. George W. Bush is the most radical president, in my view, that we've had possibly in our history. He's the first conservative Southern Republican president. In many respects, the first Confederate president outside of Jefferson Davis. He seeks to overturn not only the achievements of President Clinton, but President Roosevelt. He has a very long-term strategy of packing the courts to change our Constitution to do so. He and his followers, members of the Federalist Society, very conservative group, virtually every single appointee to the courts by George W. Bush is a member of this elite group. Believes in something called the Constitution in Exile. They believe that when Franklin D. Roosevelt became president and then gained control of the Supreme Court in 1937, that the Constitution went into exile. They seek to return to that old Constitution as they see it. That is the Constitution of the old South, of John C. Calhoun and states' rights, and also of social Darwinism and survival of the fittest before the New Deal and the government dealt with the excesses of unrestrained capitalism. And that's what they seek. If George W. Bush had his way, he'd privatize Social Security and Medicare. He has already proposed incremental programs that drive wedges into those fundamental programs. He has already overturned many of the environmental programs of President Clinton, who, by the way, put more federal land under federal protection than any president since Theodore Roosevelt, and who augmented the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, and clean air and clean water were cleaner than at any time in our history.
And you write
so that's what Bush seeks to do, and that's simply on the domestic front and not on the international front, where he is a unilateralist as opposed to a new internationalist working with our allies, particularly in the Western Alliance.
You write that when Bill Clinton took office, there was a kind of howl of agony, fury in the Republican Party. They believed that they had already secured a lock on the U.S. presidency. This was not supposed to happen.
Well, as I document in my book, Bill Clinton was regarded as illegitimate by many in the Republican Party when he was elected to the presidency in 1992. And that feeling gained force and only accumulated as the organized effort to overthrow him, and I use the word advisedly, continued all through his presidency. It's what I call the Clinton Wars.
When you say you use it advisedly, you mean literally overthrow, kick out.
Well, it resulted in an unconstitutional impeachment trial which attempted to remove the president. That was done by underhanded means. Remember, the president was acquitted of all charges. If anyone doubts that there was a vast right-wing conspiracy, you can certainly turn on Fox News and see some of it right now. There certainly was collusion with Ken Starr's office and right-wing operatives in the Paula Jones case. And there were vast multimillion-dollar dirty tricks campaigns financed by the Daddy Warbucks of the right, Richard Mellon Scaife. I think no one who reads my book will be able to deny that there's a vast right-wing conspiracy. And in fact, even my harshest conservative critics, like Andrew Sullivan, have conceded the point that I have been right on this point factually. And nobody has contested the historical accuracy of the Clinton Wars.
Well, I have to say, and I want to come back and look at this Clinton legacy and at this so-called conspiracy and find the distinction between that and just rough-and-tumble politics. But I am curious, on the front of the media reception of your book, It has had some very rough reception. Time magazine called it neither history nor journalism nor memoir. It's just more politics. Michael Isikoff, who you go after in the book, says his book isn't history. It's one big orgy of political spin. Why such a sharp-edged, sharp-nailed media response to the Clinton wars?
Well, you raise a very important question, and the answer is this, that there are members of the press who were compliant tools of right-wing operatives, of Republican congressional staffers, and of Ken Starr's office through this entire period, like Michael Isikoff, who was nothing but used during this period. And there were many others like him, and they're very defensive, and they can't come to terms with it, they can't accept responsibility, and they won't tell the truth about what they do. And they continue the smears. On the other hand, every single historian who has reviewed this book has acclaimed it, from Robert Dalek to Sean Wilentz, from David Greenberg to Jack Bass. So there's a split between the historians and those members of the press corps who are actually participants in these events, who claim a higher objectivity but in fact are completely subjective and defensive about their own roles and won't admit what they did and never challenge the facts in my book.
Jack Beatty, come in here on the Clinton legacy, if you would. You were beginning to say before the break to express some doubt about exactly whether Clinton was this progressive president that the cycle might have expected in the early 90s. How do you look back on his legacy today?
Well, I mean, I do think this policy failure in health care reform was grave and unprecedented. It would be as if FDR didn't get a vote on Social Security. The guy had the House. The guy had the Senate. He had 80% public approval that people wanted universal health care. What did he do? He turned it over to his wife, and who had closed-door meetings, who didn't educate the public about it. And then, you know, the AFL-CIO came to him and said, look, we can spend $5 million for you on health care, or we can spend $5 million against you on NAFTA. You choose. He chose NAFTA. Well, NAFTA made the lot of manufacturing workers in America more insecure. That's not what progressive presidents do. And he didn't get the benefit for them, which would be medical security, a grave failure. That led to the second failure, the 1994 election. This is just losing the House was bigger than anything else that happened in the Clinton years. And why did that happen? Because the president couldn't get his own party to bring health care to a vote, couldn't nationalize the election around that, and let Newt Gingrich and the Republicans take that election.
So are you saying that Bill Clinton was not a real progressive, or that he was inept in pushing the agenda, or he just wasn't the real thing? He was a wolf in sheep's clothing here.
He was inept, and I don't believe he was progressive. He was a business cycle president. I mean, the things that people credit him for, the unemployment, the job growth, the lower poverty, and so on, great. Budget surplus.
I'll play sarcastic there, Jack.
But functions of the business cycle. And, you know, I really think that historians will see him
Jack,
as a...
Jack, how do you account for the 93 budget, which reduced the deficit by three quarters? Not a single Republican in the House or the Senate voted for it. President Clinton took a tough decision.
But it was with George Bush's decision in 1990 to raise taxes.
But it was a very tough decision to take, and it reduced the deficit.
Undoubtedly.
And it was the catalyst for the greatest prosperity the country ever had. And furthermore, it led to the greatest increase in family income and wages in a generation and a half, the highest rate, the greatest rise in living standards of African Americans since the end of Jim Crow, a 25% reduction in poverty. Those are the facts.
Yes, but that's attributable to the American economy. It isn't as if any of that remains after Bill Clinton. We live in world Lyndon Johnson created. We live in the world that FDR created.
Jack, Bill the Clinton's... budget was made by Bill Clinton.
Well, you're putting an awful lot on a budget.
You know, we reached the lowest unemployment ever in the country's history. And that was not an accident. If you make this argument, Jack, then you're left with the argument that the economy is just the weather and we're just stuck with business cycles and presidents don't matter. And you can't make an argument against George W. Bush's economic management then, because it follows then that presidents really don't count in what they do. So if Bill Clinton took a tough decision in making the budget, and the budget went on along that way, and we created the greatest surplus, and we didn't spend that surplus on regressive taxes like George W. Bush, but invested it in Social Security and began paying down the federal debt, all of which were presidential decisions, and there were investments in education, including more than 10 million scholarships in the New Hope Scholarship Program for young people. And while you say that health care failed, and that's true, and it was a grievous, grievous failure. There were still new health care programs, including the Children's Health Insurance Program, by which more than 5 million poor children were covered. And we had portability in health care that the president fought for, and we won. We didn't get everything. Now, it's true that it failed, but it also failed for President Truman, who first endorsed it and proposed it.
Sidney Blumenthal, Jack Beattie, we've got the pieces laid out here. I want to invite our listeners in. There are a lot of them who want to join this conversation. We're talking about the American presidency and the Clinton legacy in the age of Bush. How does Bill Clinton look to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Amos is calling from North Freedom, Wisconsin. Hi, Amos. You're on the air.
Hi. I object to the way you frame the issue in terms of Clinton representing big government and Bush not representing big government. I mean, I'm coming from a kind of a libertarian small government perspective. I think there's some useful things for big government, but
I don't think I used the word big government, but I was trying to echo Sidney Blumenthal's notion of of conservatives who want to essentially put government on the sidelines and progressives who want to put government to work. Do you object to that?
I totally object to it, because if you look at what the Bush administration is doing, basically the military budget is going to take over the whole country. The privacy rights, they push really hard to take away local court decisions when it comes to drugs. Privacy, everything is being, you look at the Total Information Awareness Agency, all of this stuff is a big government with an M16 behind it.
So you see big government, but put together in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, Bush people would love to hear this being framed the way you're framing it, so they can go and say, oh, we stand for small government. I don't see any evidence at all that the Bush administration stands for small government or local control.
Interesting observation, Amos. Thanks for calling. Sidney Blumenthal.
I think you make a very good point. In fact, President Clinton sought what he called a third way between these two poles. And while the government assumed new functions during the Clinton administration, and there were many, many new programs, for example, family and medical leave, which tens of millions of people have taken advantage of so they can care for their sick relatives or take a day off from when their children need something from school or whatever they need for their families. He brought the government down to the lowest level that it was since President Kennedy without losing any productivity on its functions. It's Bush who's brought this up and there's an unthinking expansion of certain government functions now. Now, some of them are in the military, and as you raise, there are important privacy questions and civil liberty questions. There seems to be an authoritarian tinge to what's going on now, and that didn't happen really under the Clinton administration. It's a very different kettle of fish.
And yet you write that Ronald Reagan raised big deficits because he knew that that would limit government, and George Bush is certainly we're on a track toward big deficits now, which means less government, and again, a Republican kind of embrace of this as a break on government, and in the Republican view, as a way of opening the field for individual initiative.
Let's be more precise about it. That's just pure rhetoric.
Well, it's your rhetoric, Sidney Blumenthal. It's from your book.
No, it's not. No,
well,
it's not.
I'll
here's
quote
the deal.
You in a moment here.
Yeah, please do. Here's the deal. I think that Reagan came to realize that the deficit was a very effective instrument to crush social programs, and it was used to squeeze them. And in the meantime, much of government expanded. And you can look at the facts on that. The same thing is happening with George W. Bush. He is using what will be the largest deficit in our history to crush social programs all through not only the federal government, down through the states and the cities, cutting services that are essential, including schools and education. But other functions are being exorbitantly funded, but they don't get down to the services for the middle class. Those are being cut right now. So I think that you have to be very precise and think about exactly what's being cut. These are not abstractions. These are about real people's lives.
Well, we understand, we're just quoting you here saying, Reagan's aim was to paralyze government, not animate it. We understand that it can be paralyzed and animated in different quarters, but you've got the same deficit program going on now. And maybe
Absolutely. Maybe
some of the same paralysis, and maybe some of the same national support for that paralysis. George Bush is a popular president at the moment. Susan's on the line. Welcome, Susan. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. call.
Sure.
I guess my concern, and I had a professor, business law, international law professor at Fletcher about 20 years ago, the Fletcher School, who said, and he was a pretty just moderate guy. He since has died, Bill Barnes, and he said, I think you all ought to know that really the Republicans nor the Democrats ever run this country. This country is really run by a very small group. We call them the mafia, but people aren't really sure exactly who they are, but you can begin to get a sense as you get further along in international relations. And I've always thought about that, and I watched Clinton try and survive. He had a very strong personality. I think that he really had some strong social goals, with health care being one, single payer. And then I had the sense that maybe that authority once in a while was stepping in and telling him, no, you're not allowed to do this, such as we're going to have NAFTA. Even if you don't want it, we're going to have it.
But Clinton embraced NAFTA.
I know, but I'm saying it's that authority over him that embraced NAFTA, and if he wanted to stay in power, he was going to have to do this.
Susan, we've got to, let me put it to Sidney Blumenthal, and Sidney, I don't know if I describe it exactly as Susan does, but you are ready to talk about a right-wing conspiracy, and before the first break, I wanted to ask what the difference is between how concentrated, in your view of the world, is the kind of mind of that conspiracy, and what's the difference between a right-wing conspiracy and right-wing tough politics?
Well, I think that the person who called in raises a question about some sort of amorphous, unnamed power that exercised influence over President Clinton.
And I'm asking you to put a finer point on it if you can.
No, I didn't see that in that science fiction movie. That never happened. But I would say that there certainly was very strong right-wing power that existed. It existed through the Republican Congress with the rise of Newt Gingrich. It existed through various organizations and lobbying groups. It exists through conservative media. It exists through a complete infrastructure, a lot of it based in Washington, of so-called think tanks, foundations, institutes, publications, and it is vastly funded.
What makes it different than politics, than just American politics in the raw?
It's because it believes in power above all, and is ultimately unprincipled. It, as exemplified by Tom DeLay, the Republican House leader who coerced the impeachment. I talked to many moderate Republicans, which I document in my book, who told me that they were told that if they didn't vote for the impeachment, they'd have right-wing primary opponents, and their financial backers were called by a delay in his operation and coerced and threatened.
Is that not politics? Is that not just straight politics?
No, that's extraordinary politics. That's the kind of politics that is not the normal give and take, not the kind of politics where people go out for a drink together. It's not the politics of civility and democracy, and that's the politics practiced by the right wing today. It's the politics of annihilation and personal destruction.
So revolution is not a dinner party. We're talking tonight about the American presidency and the Clinton legacy with Clinton's White House advisor and unflagging supporter Sidney Blumenthal. You can join the conversation. Do the Republicans now have an electoral lock on the presidency? Can there, will there, should there be another FDR? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American presidency and the Clinton legacy with Bill Clinton's White House advisor and unflagging supporter, Sidney Blumenthal. He's out with a new book, The Clinton Wars, 800 pages, going into the charges and countercharges of the Clinton years, and a conversation, a discussion of the cycles in the American presidency of conservatism and progressivism. You can join the conversation. What is the Clinton legacy? Is it substance? Is it scandal? Is it time again for a progressive presidency, or is George W. Bush just the right medicine? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joanne's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Blumenthal, I haven't read your book yet, but I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
My question is given the current administration's efforts to put a stop to terrorism and increase security and improve protection for American people, if a new Democrat was to be elected, or Clinton could influence, the Democratic Party to you know, in its efforts to take over the White House again in the next election. How might the Democrats bring about, you know, protection for the American people? I really agreed with the caller earlier. It was a gentleman who mentioned, you know, Republicans say that they're for smaller government, and yet they've created this monstrosity Transportation Security Agency that is so unwieldy and so overbearing. So
how might a Democratic president now confront terrorism, Joanne?
Certainly, and with the influence of Clinton, because clearly, you know, his mark on the on the White House itself and on government is so strong, and Democrats such as myself identify so much with his version of you know, the Democratic Party.
We've got to do it. Let us pick it up. Cindy Blumenthal, how about it? If a Democrat makes the White House, if he's got some of the progressive stripes that you describe, how would that man or woman face the terrorism challenge?
Well, I think Joanne raises a very good question. And I think there are two answers that I hope that the Democrats address in the coming election, drawing on the Clinton legacy. To begin with, President Clinton was the one who began the Homeland Security Commission that reported eventually in the spring of 2001 to the administration of George W. Bush. Their report, it was a report that was written under the leadership of Gary Hart and Warren Rudman, a Democrat and a Republican, was ignored and tabled by the Bush administration. Eventually, it was picked up. The Democrats proposed the creation of the Homeland Security Department, and Bush seized upon it and ran upon it, even using it to make a point that the Democrats in the midterm somehow were unpatriotic, exploiting a politics of fear and insecurity. Right now, the funding for the Homeland Security Department is below what it was last year. And in particular, the funding is not what it should be for first responders. That is, in those people in the front lines who might respond to terrorism, including police and firemen. And they don't have the equipment they need, the equipment that they needed on 9/11.
But President Bush is staying on this stuff. He said it last night in his big fundraising speech. He said,
well,
the terrorists wanted war, and we've taken it to them.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm telling you what the numbers are and what the facts are about this. Then there's a second matter. I think there's a question of our long-term security, and that involves maintaining the Western alliance and all of our alliances so that our allies respect us and act cooperatively with us. Collective security is in the long-term interests of the United States. It always has been. It's the great lesson of the 20th century, and it is the lesson even more so today. It is what the Clinton legacy is about. We conducted the war in Kosovo successfully with an international coalition. It was very difficult to maintain, but President Clinton did it. And we won the war decisively using the U.S. military, a military, by the way, that President Clinton built up, and the military that won these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Let me say about this. President Bush has engaged in a unilateralist politics and policy and foreign policy in which he seeks to make the United States the preponderant nation, which of course it is, but that that works through ad hoc coalitions and picks and chooses as it will through all these situations. That is not in the long-term interest of the United States. We need collective security, and we need to bring together the Western alliance after the disastrous diplomacy, whatever you think of the Iraq war, that preceded it and has followed it. Mm. So I think the Democrats need to work on the homeland security front and in the larger issues of international policy, drawing on the Clinton legacy. Yeah,
Donald is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Donald. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
There was a call about 10 minutes ago about not so much the vast right-wing conspiracy, but a power behind the presidency, basically, or the politics that run everything in the country.
Yeah, Susan was calling in on that front.
Susan, okay. And I remember a movie, 1970, with Glenn Ford, called The Brotherhood of the Bell. I don't know if anybody has heard of it or remembers it.
Didn't see it, Donald. Didn't see it.
Yeah.
A movie.
It was a made-for-TV movie, actually.
Yeah, so should we... Why do we care?
Well, because it was all about somebody behind the scenes running and controlling everything, including the media, with their money, basically, as a power, to shape everything that happens within the country.
Donald, we've got it. And Jack Beatty, let me put this to you. Here it comes again, the notion that there's a power behind the power, behind all powers. Sidney Blumenthal brings up science fiction, but yet the callers keep coming back to it.
Yes, and, you know, there is a power. It's called the power of organized money, and it was a power that was very important in the Clinton administration. It was a power that manifested itself domestically with the Telecommunications Act of 1996, of which the current deregulation by Michael Powell is a continuation. It manifested itself abroad in the so-called Washington Consensus, which basically forced free market reforms on third world countries, some to the harm of those countries. And it certainly was manifest in NAFTA and in the reversal of trade priorities with China. And, you know, I bet you if you look at the campaign contributions from Bill Clinton, from companies that dealt in finance, from companies that dealt in exports, from high-tech companies that had interests in China and elsewhere, you would see a very healthy balance there, and it is no coincidence.
So this comes back to your skepticism about Clinton as the progressive president. You're saying that, yes, there's a power, and it was in this White House as in Republican White House.
That's right.
Sidney Blumenthal.
I think one of the great untruths that Ralph Nader stated was that there is no difference between the Republican and Democratic parties. No difference between George W. Bush and Al Gore. No difference between the Bushes and Bill Clinton.
I didn't
President
say
Clinton.
That. I'm just pointing to
I'm
these
not,
particular
I didn't
concrete
say you did, Jack.
Things.
I'm pointing out something else. And I think that that's a general idea that had a very destructive effect in the election of 2000. And it was a factor that led to Florida and led ultimately to the presidency being given to Bush by the Supreme Court. There are profound policy differences. There are sharp differences. Does that mean that there are not commercial interests on the Democratic side? On the contrary, there certainly are. And in fact, I believe that someone like Bill Clinton did more for individual initiative and for business than any Republican has.
Sidney Blumenthal, we just got a minute left. I want you to look forward for a moment. We get that you endorse this Clinton presidency. The Times describes you as performing acrobatic feats of protectiveness, but we understand what you're saying. Looking forward, where do you see the next bearer of your torch there?
Well, I'm not choosing an individual candidate. I think that what the Democrats need to learn from are the following aspects of the Clinton legacy. One, economic management. We had the greatest prosperity in the country's history, and it was shared by more people than ever before. Two, internationalist foreign policy as opposed to unilateralist foreign policy. Three, a program, an ideal of one America, of inclusion, of not only talking the talk but walking the walk.
Are you looking forward to Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate?
I look forward to Hillary, who's certainly not running, endorsing the incumbent Democratic president in 2008. That is my view about the matter. And I also think that Democrats need to learn from Clinton politically. They need to stand up for themselves, or else people won't think that they can stand up for them. This is a representative office in a democracy, and they need to practice the politics of hope and possibility based on real policies that work. And people did feel that under Clinton.
Sidney Blumenthal, we're out of time, but we can feel you ushering Bill Clinton right back into the room. I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Sidney Blumenthal is author of the new book, The Clinton Wars. He was senior White House advisor to Bill Clinton from 1997 to 2001. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, Saudi Arabia and France launch campaigns to lure American tourists back to their shores. This is On Point. War, terrorism, and bad economic times have been crippling the tourism industry around the world. Two countries that have been particularly hard hit, France and Saudi Arabia, are taking to the airwaves to solve the image problems they face in the United States, or at least to try. Saudi Arabia is remembered by many Americans as home to most of the September 11th hijackers. The recent terrorist attack in Riyadh has led the State Department to recommend against visiting the kingdom. In response, the Saudi embassy is running ads in the top 25 American markets this month, promoting a positive image of the country. Here are two commercials from the ad campaign titled, The People of Saudi Arabia, Allies Against Terrorism.
We are separated by three oceans, one language, but we share the same desires, the same dreams, the same joy, the same pain, and the same hope that we can make our world a safer place. Together. The people of Saudi Arabia. In 30 years, Saudi Arabia has changed from a desert kingdom into a modern nation. A nation whose citizens are educated and committed to a more secure future. We are proud of how far we've come in 30 years and look forward to strengthening our alliances. The people of Saudi Arabia.
Meanwhile, France has enlisted some big names in its media campaign. Woody Allen, Wynton Marsalis, George Plimpton, and others tout the long friendship that France and America have enjoyed in a new promotional video. That friendship was wounded for many Americans when France refused to support the U.S. in its war in Iraq. The first quarter of 2003, an estimated 20% fewer Americans visited France than in the same period in 2002. Here's an excerpt from the new French video, beginning with Woody Allen.
The United States and France have been great friends and great, great allies going back many, many years to the birth of both these two great democracies. And recently, there has been a lot of controversy between the countries. And I would hope that now that the two countries could put all that behind them and start to build on what really has been a great, great friendship and hopefully a great, great future. And no one will be petty about this, and we can forget about our differences. And I will not have to refer to my French fried potatoes as freedom fries, and I don't have to freedom kiss my wife when what I really want to do is French kiss her. So let's pull together now.
I love France. I've never had a bad experience.
I love the culture, their sensibility, their art. Everything.
France is one of my favorite countries. I love France. I've been there, I think, 35 times.
The French are definitely, I mean, in love with the American, and I think America has been in love with France for many, many years.
Hemingway, who lived in France and adored it and wrote about it, said, if you are lucky enough to have lived as a young man in France, it always stays with you. Now, I lived in Paris when I was young. I dream about France all the time. And that's because the countryside, its cathedrals, its history is so monumental. I mean, how can you go through life without having been to the Louvre, or to go to the Chateau country, or to try French wines in a French restaurant, or to talk to French people? The French are wonderful at making you feel at home. Oscar Wilde said, for an example, that good Americans, when they die, they go to heaven. The very, very good Americans go to Paris.
Excerpts of a new promotional video encouraging Americans to visit France, Saudi Arabia, and France there, searching for the comeback trail. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.